It's now time for the Fantasy 411 Podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411 Podcast. I'm Matthew Leach, talking with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke, and it is time. We've got pitchers and catchers reporting. We've got college baseball starting this weekend. And we had what you might call fantasy baseball's opening day with the labor experts draft. Fred was a part of that. How did that go?
I thought it went pretty well. I mean, it's always sometimes frustrating when you do one of those experts drafts because you don't end up getting everything that you wanted. But in the end, I was pretty happy with how my team starts out.
Excellent. We are going to spend a good bit of time on that. But as we have made habit, we are going to start with the transactions and news in baseball this week. And the first one that jumps out is the trade of Chris Davis. Not that one, the other one. And the first thing that obviously comes to my mind for a guy like that is the change in ballpark. What do you make of Davis and his new surroundings?
Yeah, he loses some fantasy value here, in my opinion. The park is going to impact him. It has, it should take a few home runs away. And playing time could be a bit of a concern. I felt like he was kind of locked into playing basically every day with the Brewers. With the A's, I know he's a starter for them, and he should be a key piece to them, but they do have a bench, and the A's do like to rotate players. So, I mean, even losing one start a week, adds up after a while.
He's an interesting guy, and I say that a lot. He's a guy I'm still not entirely sure what to make of. 27 home runs last year and 440 at-bats, that was a big step forward. And yet, even in Milwaukee, I can't shake some skepticism about him. I can't even explain why. I've never been sure I really buy it. Do you buy him as sort of context-independent, as a serious power producer, even if we're dinging him some for going to Oakland? Or do you share my can't-entirely-explain-why skepticism about him?
Yeah, when he was still with the Brewers, I felt that I was going to project him in the high 20s for homers, and at that point, then I'd want him in a mixed league. Now in Oakland, I'm starting to feel more low 20s, and now that I feel low 20s, I'm not as excited about him because you're not going to get a high batting average. You get a few steals, but not enough to really matter. My concern with owning Davis, I kind of feel like with Davis, you either have to be in or out. He's really streaky, and you're going to have periods where you think you made the best decision ever with him and then periods where you just want to drop him. And the truth is you probably just need to plug him in and leave him there so that you get the best of both worlds, because I don't really think you can time it.
Yeah, he's I will not be buying on him, but I'm sure a lot of other people will. Moving down, another not really surprising development. The other thing with this is we don't really know how it's going to shake down. Sounding like Jose Fernandez, unsurprisingly, is going to be on some kind of innings limit, maybe 180 or so. I think we really don't know. The Marlins aren't really saying, and as we learned with Matt Harvey last year, sometimes these things can change in August and September. But does that affect your evaluation of him at all? Or is part of this, you kind of know even before that you're not counting on Fernandez for 200, 210 innings this year.
That's right, and the fact that you aren't counting on him for that innings total has to affect your value of him a little bit, in the sense of if we were projecting 210 innings for Fernandez, and I have a hope that some year down the road we will be able to do that, at that point he could be top three, top four starter. I mean, his career ratios are outstanding, his strikeout rate's outstanding, but now that we have him at 180 and there's so many good starters out there, now to me he falls to more like a low-end ace, more like 10th to 12th ranked starter, where you're fine with him as your ace, but he can't be in that Scherzer Arrieta class if he's going to throw 40 less innings than those pitchers.
It is an interesting question, though, right? Because on an inning by inning, start by start basis, you can make a case, and I don't know that I would, but I think you at least make the case that the only guy you clearly rank ahead of him just on inning for inning, start for start, is Kershaw. I really think that's not absurd. His best is that good. Do you at least see a case for bumping him up a little bit from where you have him and just saying, look, it's only 180 innings, but boy, is he going to be good when he pitches him?
Yeah, I can understand that for sure. It's about how those 180 innings are going to arrive for your team, in the sense of, you're probably not too excited if they're going to shut him down, in early September, which I don't think will probably be their plan, which means that they probably are just going to maybe skip him or push him back at times to kind of limit his innings. that doesn't make you too excited because, like, if he's your ace, you need to be able to count on using him every week and getting good production from him. And, I mean, also if they were going to kind of shorten some of his starts at times and pull him after five or something, like, that could affect his win total. They're not a great offensive club to begin with. So, and, again, you wins are hard to predict, but you're hoping to get more than 15 wins from your ace.
That's a good and fair point. And then a smaller deal, kind of thing we might not otherwise talk that much about, but you made a good observation here. Ike Davis going to Texas. Well, he's kind of been an Ike Davis honk, but I like him more as a ball player than as a fantasy player. Might mean something to Joey Gallo, who's somebody we've talked about and somebody who I think a lot of people are excited about. How does it affect how you look at Gallo on draft day?
Yeah, Ike Davis signing for me kind of counterbalances a bit of the enthusiasm for Gallo related to Josh Hamilton already having troubles with his knee. In the sense of, if Gallo's on the roster, you assume he's going to play fairly regularly. And at that point, I mean, he's worth a flyer at the end of a mixed league to see if he could at least hit 230 to go along with a lot of power. Ike Davis now gives them an option to send Gallo to the minors to start the season. And they have some of those other Justin Ruggiano types in the outfield too. So they can just kind of keep a veteran bench and then put Gallo in the minors, and at that point he's got to start the season on waivers and mixed leagues. It's something we'll have to monitor during spring training. There's so many ways for Gallo to get in the regular lineup, as far as Beltre could be injured, or Moreland, or Fielder, or Hamilton, and they could shuffle and get him in, but he's going to have to show them in spring training that that's worth their trouble.
And now we move to what should be the bulk of our conversation today, the Labor Mixed League 15-team draft that happened earlier this week. There's a lot to unpack, and I want to start with something that actually didn't affect you, but obviously people talk about this, people are interested. Something, a topic we talked about recently, and that's the top of the draft. And the top of this one went Trout, Goldschmidt, Harper, which I think is a little different from maybe what we had come down on. What do you think went into that? Were you surprised at all, or are those guys close enough that no order is really all that shocking?
I wasn't surprised at all. And even though I would go Harper, Trout, Goldschmidt in any order, in any draft, like, I think is unsurprising. The only time it would be surprising to me is if somebody else joins that. Kershaw still wouldn't shock me, but if Kershaw joined that in a roto league especially, I'd find it a little surprising. But for those three hitters, I can't argue with anyone really who wants to put them in any order that they choose.
Elsewhere in the first round, and again, we will certainly talk plenty about your selections, but there was a lot worth breaking down here. One of the things that I think drew some attention that I saw some people noting was Anthony Rizzo goes 5 overall. We had talked about whether he might challenge Paul Goldschmidt in that first-tier first baseman. That seems to suggest that at least in some quarters, he does have that view. I guess it's the same question. Were you surprised to see Rizzo go that high, and what do you think is sort of the reasoning that gets him up to that kind of stance?
I was a little surprised because I feel like now you're building in a fair amount of improvement to get him up to 5. I'm fine with him maybe more around 9 or 10, but I guess that's splitting hairs a little bit. I understand that once you really get past four or five in a mixed league draft that it gets pretty jumbled. So, I mean, I get it. There's tremendous buzz about the Cubs lineup right now, and he's right in the heart of it. And if you feel like you can get 30 homers and a 295 average, and with him the speed, like after last season, like if you feel like you can get 15 steals, then I understand he's almost like a bit of a Goldschmidt light. But, I mean, now we're getting him right up near the top. I felt like it was pretty aggressive, but not crazy in the sense of I'm fine with him as a first-rounder to begin with.
He also seems to be a very high-floor guy. He seems like a guy that, now again, I would hope that anybody who take 5 overall is not going to bust. But, you know, even compared to the guys who come after him in that draft, Arenado, still young, I don't know. I could see him having some fallback. Machado has had trouble staying healthy. Stanton, you wonder about his health. Correa needs to do it again. You know, I think if you take that sequence of guys, McCutchen, Cabrera, the sequence of guys that go there in a 6 or 7 pick span, I think the one thing maybe you can say about Rizzo, do you agree with me that he probably has the highest floor of those guys, maybe the lowest ceiling of them, but the guy that you're most confident in that bunch, he's going to be really good for me.
Yeah, he very well may. Also, though, McCutcheon, I'd say, is the other one who has a really high floor. I think we almost saw the floor last season, and even though it was a little disappointing, it was still really good.
No, absolutely. And that is the other guy that jumps out to me from that list. One last thing before we talk about your draft. Four third basemen go in the first round. As you approach third base, as you go forward and do more drafting over the next month, does that affect how you look at that position? Does it change your view on third base when you see Arenado, Machado, Donaldson, and Bryant all go in the first 13 picks?
It doesn't really, because my goal in any draft is just draft the best player I can in the first few rounds, and then I'll start working on the positions after that. And there's depth at third base if you want to look later in your draft. My most shocking part of the first round was that Donaldson fell all the way out of the top 10 and was drafted after Arenado and Machado. To me, that didn't really make sense. Like, a lot of the players, when you talk about high floor, I feel like he has the highest floor of anyone outside of those top four picks. He would have been the player I would have taken fifth over Rizzo. I just feel in that offense, coming off the year he just had with that home park, like, to me, his floor is probably low 30s homers, 100 runs, 100 RBIs, and a solid batting average. And, I mean, we saw last year he could go up to the 120 mark in both runs and RBIs. So, to me, he's the really nice blend of a high floor and a high ceiling, and I was really shocked to see him go down as far as he did.
For a second there, you got your hopes up.
I sure did. I knew it wasn't going to happen, but then when it gets to just one or two picks away from you, you think, well, maybe, just maybe the guy right ahead of me is married to someone else and is going to take them for sure.
So we look at your selections, and you had 14-17, which is a in some ways a really good position to be in some ways probably maddening when you're waiting, whatever it is, 28 picks or 26 picks between when you go. But Jose Altuve at 14, Mookie Betts, a guy we talked about in email this week, at 17, Did you view them as a package? Do you think when you're taking Altuve, you're going to get Betts still on the board at 17? When you're doing that, first philosophically, do you only view a kind of package deals when you are at the end of the round, or do you think of a little bit about that when you've got two spots between your picks?
Yes, picking at the end, either end, is a really good way to have structure to building your team. It's not always the best way to get value because you miss long stretches of picks where maybe someone drops a bit, especially in the early rounds, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's unlikely when it gets to you in those early rounds that there's going to be two players who have dropped a lot. At the same time, it's a nice way to build your team in the sense you basically pick in pairs. As you mentioned, we had emailed back and forth a little bit and talked about some of the options in round two, and I was pretty firm going into the draft that I was going to take Betts in the second round unless something really unusual fell to me. And I was going to take him no matter who I took in round one, because two picks into your draft, your team's barely formed. I'm just looking to get players I believe in for 2016. I was happy Altuve fell. He's kind of in my top 10 to 12. So I was happy about that. And I feel like he's a really safe player. He's durable. You know, he's a five-category producer now, and he plays a premium position. So I was happy to start with him. But I would have gone Betts had I taken someone like Miguel Cabrera, had he fallen to me or something. No matter what, I think I wanted to identify the best picks in those early rounds and not worry about what those players specifically were good at.
And then I did want to talk some about Mookie Betts, who we have not talked a lot about on here prior to today. He's a guy that you know, we both really like a lot, and he was a little inconsistent last year. There was some time in mid-season where there was some wonder if he'd been exposed a little bit. Then he comes on, and you look at the numbers at the end of the year, and they're just absurd. Some of that is not fantasy stuff. I ran a little query on the play index. Guys with his combination of extra base hits, stolen bases, and relatively low strikeout totals, and it's about three guys in history at that age. What's your read on Betts? How high is his ceiling? How high is his floor? I mean, he's unbelievably exciting, but when you kind of analyze him, what is it that jumps out to you?
Yeah, it's his ability to maybe be a five-category stud. That's what we're looking at. I think he's one of those players who can make the major jump, like we saw someone like Machado do last year. I mean, I guess Betts can't make that high of a jump because he was so good already last season, but I think he can go. And maybe it all won't happen this year, but I think it's going to happen, and it's going to happen in pretty short order. He can go into the 20s in homers with the steals. Like, he didn't steal as much as I had hoped in the second half. At the same time, he did kind of have that time where he hit the wall, and then he was kind of shaken up for a little while after that. And you wonder, like, was he playing, but they're deciding not really to push it, and they're not in the race anymore. I feel like, looking at his minor league numbers, like, this is someone who has 30 steal potential in the majors. And he was hitting well over 300 after the beginning of June. As you mentioned, he started slowly. But if he puts that all together, and I really like that lineup. I ended up not having the option of taking A.J. Pollock, but I debated him and Pollock a lot recently. And one thing, a big plus in Bet's favor, is he's hitting leadoff in what I believe will be a much better lineup than the one that Pollock will play in.
What kind of potential do you think he has as far as average? I mean, look at the guy. He didn't have a whole lot of full seasons at one level, so it's kind of hard to make too much of it. But you see a 335, a 355, a 346 in 99 games in 2014. I mean, do you think this is a guy who can be, probably not be a 350 hitter in the majors, but who can be a 320 kind of hitter in the major leagues?
Yeah, I do. And I don't know if that, again, I don't know if that'll happen this year. He's still so young, but I felt safe projecting him to hit 300, and then I'm hoping maybe I can get 310 out of him. And, I mean, I'd be ecstatic if I could get 320. I do think he'll have some of those seasons, though. He just kind of has everything. He has terrific play skills. He has speed. You know, he seems like a hardworking, energetic guy who's going to maximize his talents, like, and he's in a really good situation. So, yeah, for me, I just felt like maybe this another step forward is going to happen this year, and I wanted to be a part of it. And then I didn't really nitpick about whether I was getting him, you know. I would have considered him at 14 if Altuve didn't drop and I didn't like the options, although it's almost like they're the same pick because they're so close together.
We talk about a sort of broader thing in this draft. One thing you noted is that it seems like the general consensus on starting pitchers has shifted a little bit. And we talked a little about this with Kershaw, but he's his own category. But it does seem like that. Don't overdraft a starter, be really hesitant to draft starting pitchers early, may have faded a little. Do you think that was just a one-draft thing, or do you think maybe there's some sort of sea change in how starters are viewed in fantasy?
I think we've seen that change, and I think it started in some of the high-stakes leagues around the industry, and people started investing more in starters, and now you've seen some of the quote-unquote experts kind of catch on to that. There was a real consensus for a lot of years not to draft starters early because they could get hurt or they could have poor seasons and they were going to fluctuate and it wasn't worth it. And at that point, I felt like there was actually a really good buying opportunity for people who went against the grain on that. Now the consensus seems to have come around. I mean, if you're going to draft Kershaw in the top five picks, it's hard to say that no other starter should go in the first two rounds. I know he's the best, but there's a lot that are really good. So, and I was a little surprised in this draft. Last year, for example, I believe only about two or three pitchers went in the second round and then maybe like four more in the third round. And this year we saw a few go in the second round and then a real run in the third round where by the time we're at the end of the third round, pretty much every owner has their ace. I think maybe every owner had their ace by then and one owner had two. So it's kind of hitting that point where if you want a top 12, 15 starter, you better be ready to invest a pick in the first three rounds.
And the sequence of these guys kind of caught my eye to some extent. I'm looking at this. First of all, Scherzer is the next one who goes after Kershaw. Is he a clear number two, a second-ranked starting pitcher for you? Because there's a pretty long gap. It's Kershaw, Scherzer, Arrieta, but Scherzer is the only guy to go in about a 15-pick range. Do you think is that about where you have him?
To me, it's kind of a coin flip at number two for pitchers between him and Arrieta. I know Kershaw has the awesome strikeout rate. I think some people who stopped paying attention maybe late in the season missed the fact that he wasn't really great in the second half. His ERA in the second half, so his ERA from the All-Star break until he made a start in the final weekend against the Mets was over four, which is not what you'd expect for someone who you're talking about taking as a second starting pitcher. Then he dominated a Mets team that was already looking ahead to the postseason, brought it down a little bit. I think his second half ERA was still around 3.7. So, I mean, he was homer prone in the second half. I get it. I don't expect that to happen this year. But that's enough of a blip combined with what Arrieta did that I would consider taking Arrieta ahead of him.
This is a guy that jumped out at me, and I'll be honest, I kind of slept on this guy last year, which sounds funny for somebody as prominent as he is. But Madison Bumgarner is a guy for a long time I had as very good pitcher,
durable, great postseason, a good two. And I kind of slept on the numbers he put up last year, and they were ridiculous. Had 234 Ks and 39 walks last year. Strikeout rate has been going up, up, up since about 2012. Walk rate going down. It's like the performance matched the reputation last year, which doesn't always happen. It sometimes goes the other way around. But how high are you on Bumgarner coming off of a year that last year was really a step forward from even what he'd done before?
Yeah, I think he has to be in the top five starters now. I was wary of him last season coming off the huge postseason workload from the previous year. But for now, I think we just enjoy the ride. And maybe in a few years we're talking about him like how we're talking about King Felix or Verlander right now as someone who's just had a heavy workload. But that's not a concern right now. And everything is really in his favor right now. He's got that very pitcher-friendly home park. He's got a really good team around him that has rebuilt itself in the offseason. I think he's a top five starter who can win 20 games and you wouldn't be surprised. And I think just everything around him kind of gives him a bit of a buffer where even if he has an off month or something, the ratios won't be too bad.
Do you think it's safe to say he's the safest non-Kershaw starting pitcher? He's the highest floor non-Kershaw starter?
Yeah, it probably is. I think Arrieta's pretty safe, but I guess he's not as safe as Bumgarner. Arrieta has been great for now two straight seasons, so I believe he's pretty safe. But, yeah, I think Bumgarner is. You know, I wouldn't argue with someone, for example, who wanted to take Chris Sale ahead of him because Sale has that potential to have a monster strikeout season. And 1 year we'll probably see that where you know, he strikes out 280 batters or something like that. But there's just no knowing when that season's going to be. And he plays against a lot more than Bumgarner as far as his home park, the league he pitches in, the team he pitches for. So, yeah, Bumgarner almost has no knock against him.
Moving a little later in the draft, one thing you noted is that you went through an entire draft and didn't get really one power monster, that one guy who's really going to put up the huge numbers. Are you comfortable with how that turned out, or is there maybe a point where you might have wished you had gone after one guy who was more safe for power numbers?
I definitely could have gone in that direction. For example, I could have drafted Jose Bautista or Edwin Encarnacion or someone like that instead of Betts in round two, and that would have left my team maybe without as much of a glaring weakness. At the same time, I think a big mistake owners make, especially in leagues that have trades, in this league you can trade, is to draft their team like it's a finished product, because it isn't. You know, I'm drafting solely for value all the way through, because the truth is, you know, I'll probably make 10 trades in this league over the course of the season, and my team will be remodeled many times. And the best way to be able to make trades is to have good players who are playing well. So that's what I'm looking for throughout the draft. And if I'm a little light on power, and if it turns out that that's true, and at the end of April I'm falling behind there, then I'll make a move. But I don't think you should make a draft pick where, you know, you're just halfway through your draft and you're like, oh, I have to draft Mark Trumbo now, you know, over this other player who I like more than him or believe in more, because I have to have power. Just, you know, stick with your rankings and get the best team that you can.
Guy, you noted as an interesting pick that I agree is worth talking about. You take Yu Darvish in the 10th round, if I'm doing the math right. That's roughly 137 overall. He's obviously a guy with big questions around him. Other starters on the board at that point, Pineda, Steven Matz, McCullers, Odorizzi, to give people sort of an idea of where in the draft we are at this point. Liriano, Tanaka, and Stroman had come off the board recently. What is it that gives you confidence in Yu Darvish to take him and rely on him as your third starting pitcher at this point?
Sure. Well, we saw with Fernandez last season when he came back that a really talented starter, when he comes back, can hit the ground running, you know, and have quality starts right away. One of the things that made Darvish kind of fit for me, the two starters that I had already drafted were Dallas Keuchel and Sonny Gray. I didn't mind taking them as my top two starters. I think I'll get good ratios from them. But they're not really high strikeout guys as in comparison to some of the other guys that went it really early. I just kind of missed out on some of the runs being on the end of those rounds. I narrowly missed out on Corey Kluber in the third and John Lester in the fifth, and then had to settle for the other guys. So I felt like I was a little low as far as strikeouts went. And Darvish is someone who can fix that in a hurry when he gets back. And, I mean, your team's usually the healthiest in April. I can, you know, play the matchups and move guys around and compensate for him in April, and then I just hope he meets his return date. And by the middle of May, I've got someone who's striking up more than a batter per inning.
Another thing you note is you got a lot of Royals, and this is something I think we talk about more in football. You play fantasy football, and you worry about you don't want to have the quarterback and the wide receiver, number one wide out, and the tight end all from the same team. There's some inherent risk in there. Do you think there is inherent risk when you have a bunch of guys in the core of the same lineup, or is that less of a worry in a baseball lineup?
Yeah, I don't think it's much of a worry, especially in a roto league. I mean, there'll be days where the Royals score 9 runs, and I have a great night, and there'll be days where the Royals score 1, and I don't, you know. But the production should be there. The only time I could see it in a baseball league is in a weekly head-to-head league, in the sense of if the Royals have a really daunting schedule 1 week, you know, now I'm looking at, you know, giving up a lot for that week and maybe losing that week, and you hope that week doesn't come, you know, at a really key week in your season. But if you believe in the individual players, even if one of my Royals gets hurt, it's not like their lineup just falls apart.
Yeah. No, I think that's a fair point. So the last thing I want to talk about with your draft is you get towards the end, and we were talking before we started recording, there are 435 picks in this thing. It's sometimes sort of hard to remember that there are guys that you might not naturally think get selected in an experts mixed league that go because it's pick number 401 or 417 or whatever. Two guys that jumped out to me from your draft were Josh Tomlin and Bartolo Colon. At this point in the draft, there's a lot of personal preference at this point. There's not necessarily a lot to separate value from value at that point. So what made those guys you liked that you had your eye on to fill out a roster?
Yeah, I mean, Tomlin's kind of a high upside guy where when he's good, he's really good. He keeps the whip down, and then sometimes when he's bad, he's really bad. But he was really good at the end of last season, so that gives you a nice starting point. Colon, to me, is just pretty consistent, and he's got that rotation spot locked up. He's going to throw every fifth game, you know, probably all season, because I'm sure someone will be injured in the Mets rotation, you know, by the time Zach Wheeler gets back. I mean, it's pretty good odds. But the late rounds, to me, you can go one of two directions. You can kind of go, you know, the dart throw, the all or nothing kind of pick, or you can go kind of the safe. There is some value in getting, especially in a deep league like a 15-teamer, like getting some guys who can just fill spots for you earlier in the year. And that's what I was thinking with some of my late picks, especially after I drafted Darvish. I know that I'm going to need a deep group of those not-so-awesome starters so that I can play matchups so that for the first few weeks of the season until I get him back, I can make up for his absence. You pick up guys, like I pick up guys like Colon, Tomlin, Robbie Ray, who I'm kind of interested in, you know, in the late rounds, and hopefully I can just kind of cycle them each week based on, you know, who I like their matchup. And then that can get me through. I mean, I know those guys aren't exciting, and people love to take the guy in AAA who, when he gets called up, could be really impactful. But sometimes you need those boring guys just to get you through each week.
I mean, ideally, you want some of both, right? Ideally, you want, as you note, Ryan Madsen as a guy who might get you some saves, and you want, you know, also looking down here, somebody like Didi Gregorius, who's just going to be an everyday shortstop. Those are guys who both go in the last three rounds. What you really want is to be in a position where you can take some of both of those guys at the end.
Yeah, for sure. And, yeah, I took Madsen with my very last pick, and that's kind of that all-or-nothing pick. I think Sean Doolittle's a terrific pitcher, and if healthy, I think he's a fine closer. But he wasn't healthy for very long last season, and he could show up at spring training and be terrific, or he could show up at spring training and say, my shoulder hurts, and all of a sudden we're looking at Ryan Madsen as a probably second- or third-tier closer, but a pretty good closer. So, I mean, he's just that all-or-nothing pick, and I'll know in 6 weeks whether he's all-or-nothing. And if he's nothing, I can always drop him at that time or maybe stash him on my bench if I have room. And like you said, you have to balance kind of those things so that you have a little bit of everything on your bench. You can't be left with those empty roster spots in a week because you've got all these lottery tickets waiting on your bench.
All right. I think that'll be a wrap for that for now. We may come back to it we'll certainly talk about your team and the league as the year goes on. But one other thing we want to get to, we have been going through rankings by position, and shortstop is one. I haven't actually done the math, but I find it hard to believe there's another position where MLB.com's rankings have a gap so wide between the first and second player. We have Carlos Correa, number 6 overall, and we have Xander Bogaerts, number 56 overall. Is shortstop the clearest, there is one guy in tier 1 and nobody else with him of any position?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we talk about Correa as even being in the discussion for first pick overall, depending on the format of a league, and going in the top 10 in almost every draft. And then you're looking at, you know, in a 12-team, standard 12-team league, we're kind of saying no other shortstops in at least the first four rounds, and maybe even the first five rounds. So, yeah, it's a huge gap. I don't think that means necessarily that you have to bump up the value of Correa a lot, but it does matter, the fact that he's so much better than everyone else at his position, or at least he should be.
Do you think that it's going to happen, though? I mean, do you think that that's something to be aware of as you go into draft days, that some people around you might say, man, if I don't get this guy, I'm not getting a shortstop that's anywhere near him? Is it almost a kind of a fade-the-public move as this comes, that you just need to be aware that this guy might be off the board three or four, and you just need to be prepared for the fact that if you're picking 6, 7, 8, 9, you're not taking a shortstop to the fifth round?
Yeah, I think there's three ways you can probably approach the shortstop position this year. You can either say, I'm going to try to draft Correa in the first round, depending on what your pick is, if it makes sense. For a lot of people, it won't make sense. So then you'll say, okay, I'm going to target one of those second-tier shortstops that we'll get to in a moment in, say, the fifth round. That's going to be kind of my target round, maybe the fourth round if there's one you really like. If not, say the fifth round, I'm going to target one of those guys and get them there. Or you can say, forget it, I just don't think the value's there, I'll just get a shortstop late. And in my early drafts so far, I've been of that mindset, just saying if I'm not reaching for one. If the shortstop has to be the worst player in my starting lineup, then he's the worst player in my starting lineup, and maybe I'll find someone during the season that turns out better than I hoped.
Yeah, I think that's the really interesting thing here. I mean, to me, I'm looking at these rankings, and I don't see a huge gap for me between Tier 2 and even Tier 4. Tulowitzki is obviously a guy who could really blow up in a good way or a bad way, frankly. Seager is certainly a guy who could have a great year. But then you go down, and look at somebody like Brandon Crawford in Tier 4. I think I'm with you. I think there's a case to be made to wait. Before we get to 4, I do want to talk a little about one of these guys in Tier 2, and that's Xander Bogaerts. MLB.com has him 56 overall. I love him as a player. I love that broad-based skill set. I love the number of things he does well. But I look at the numbers, and I'm not sure that I'm that crazy about him fantasy. You've got to believe, to me, you have to believe that either the power or the steals are going to take a big leap forward this year for him to kind of stand out. Which of those do you see that you like about him?
Yeah, I could see the power taking a bit of a jump at one point. We can maybe even compare him as a poor man's Mookie Betts, like from us having talked about one of his teammates earlier on, where like we're both really high on Mookie, and we feel like he could maybe just take an across-the-board jump this year, hit for a higher average, steal more bases, hit more home runs than last season. Bogaerts isn't going to hit for a higher average, but if you feel like the power and the speed could go up a little bit. The other nice thing with Bogaerts, I always like to look at situations around them, and Bogaerts hits third in that nice Red Sox lineup. So that's like gives him maybe a little nice base for runs and RBIs and helps him out along the way. I feel like they're so interesting as far as he's interesting, Francisco Lindor is interesting, Corey Seager's interesting. Probably by the end of the season, we're talking about one of them as the clear-cut second-best shortstop for 2017, and there's probably one of them that really disappoints us and maybe one of them that just continues along on his path, but one of them probably really ascends this year. That's my guess. It's just hard to try to figure out which one.
Is there two separate questions here? Is there one of those guys you particularly like the breakout potential? And is there one of those guys that you're particularly worried about the bust potential this year?
Yeah, I like, if they're all sitting there, I like Bogaerts because of the foundation around him. And he has a little more experience than those other players. I do like Lindor. I don't think he can keep up the power pace he had last season, but I like him because he can kind of contribute in all areas. Seager might be the one I worry about the most, not questioning his prospect status. I get it. Like, I get he's going to be really good in the long run, but he doesn't steal bases. So for him to be a real difference maker in his rookie year, he's going to have to hit for a high average and hit for power. He doesn't play in a hitter-friendly home park. He plays in a lineup that's good, but has a lot of wild cards in it. So he's probably the one I worry about the most.
Do you also share my worry about him slightly, not a lot, because he's so polished and so good, but I have a little worry about the Dodgers' patience. You see, you see all the reactions to Jock Peterson last year. And look, I know Jock Peterson's average just went off a cliff, but guy's still a pretty good player. You see the sort of hysteria around the Dodgers at all times. You just see that whole kind of burbling pot of Dodgerness. And I worry a little that Corey Seager has a bad month and they really overreact. Do you see that potential at all, or is he such kind of a golden child that's not really a worry?
No, that's a worry for sure. I mean, the Dodgers are a team that's going for it. If Lindor has a bad month, the Indians are going to stick with him. I mean, they love his defense, and they're a team that hopes to compete this year, but probably doesn't have quite as high expectations as the Dodgers or the payroll the Dodgers have. Yeah, for sure. I mean, if Seager had a bad month, let's say Jimmy Rollins is still sitting out there. I mean, he wasn't good for the Dodgers last year, but if Seager had a really bad month and Jimmy Rollins is still sitting at home, you start hearing the whispers, you know, maybe we need to bring in a veteran. Maybe this kid needs more time in the minors. Like, it could happen. I don't think all that is going to happen. You could also just see him push down the lineup. And if you put him in a National League lineup down 7th or 8th, then that really limits his ability to get counting stats for you.
Yeah. And then you've got in Tier 3 a couple of guys that I have no idea what to do with, either one of them. Maybe that's why they're not in 2 or 4. Elvis Andrus and Ian Desmond. How do you evaluate either of these two guys? Because I find them both utter wild cards.
Yeah, if I was going to push them to a tier, it would be 4. They do have some potential that kind of keeps them out of that 4th tier. For Desmond, assuming he signs soon, it's just that really nice power-speed combination that few shortstops can match. I mean, we're talking about someone who was a 2020 player and is still young enough to do that again, but, man, with the strikeouts and the batting average declining, it's hard to believe in that. He's a nice fit maybe depending on how you've already set up your roster. You know, if you like, you know, your batting average so far and you feel like you have some safe guys in the middle of your draft, he's a guy you could take a chance on. Andrus, I feel like Andrus gets a really hard time in the fantasy circles because he was expected by a lot of people to be awesome, and he clearly isn't. But he's not that bad. You know, and he can hit in the 260s, steal you 25 to 30 bases, scores runs. You know, he's fine. I just think we have to accept that he's not going to be what some people. I remember him going in the 3rd round of drafts at times because people were expecting a big breakout and it didn't happen. But we can't necessarily hate him for that. He still does have value and he's still in a good lineup.
And then we go to tier 4, and the one guy who really jumps out. I should read the list you have there: Jose Reyes, Starlin Castro, Eugenio Suarez, Alcides Escobar, and Brandon Crawford. And to me, one of those guys jumps out. Look, I know Brandon Crawford had never done that before and may never do it again. Brandon Crawford hit 21 home runs last year, drove in 84 runs as a shortstop. I feel like even if he gives some of that back, he is a guy I really like. If we're talking about him at that kind of level, to me, he's clearly the choice of those. Are you just really kind of that skeptical on how much of what he did he can repeat?
Yeah, and it's also of the different ways he can help your team, and there aren't too many of them because he doesn't steal bases and he doesn't hit for a high average. And even last season, he didn't hit for a high average, even when he was hitting for power. So I feel like to keep him, for him to get, say, even into the 3rd tier, the 20 home runs has to stick. And if that 20 home runs regresses even to, say, 16, and now you're talking about a 16 home run guy, which is fine, but, I mean, Suarez can probably hit 16 home runs, I mean, based on what he did last year, and his home park, and I mean, Crawford's not helped by his home park. Crawford hits in the kind of 6th-ish in that lineup, so he doesn't get hit near the top. And it's just kind of all those things added together. I feel like Crawford's fine, but because he doesn't steal bases or hit for average, I feel like the ceiling's pretty low.
All right, well, that's another Fantasy 411 podcast in the books. I'm Matthew Leach, talking with Fred Zinke. Let's do this again next week, what say?
For sure. Looking forward to it.